The House Committee on the Judiciary will come to order. Without objection, the chair is authorized to declare recesses of the committee.
Object.
Objection noted. The quorum is present. We are conducting this hearing on the impeachment inquiry into President Donald J. Trump. Presentations from the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Judiciary Committee pursuant to House Resolution 660 and the Special Judiciary Committee procedures that are described in Section 4A of that resolution. Here is how the committee will proceed for this hearing. I will make an opening statement, and then I will recognize the ranking member for an opening statement. After that, we will hear two sets of presentations. We will hear 30-minute opening arguments from counsels for the majority and the minority of this committee. Order in the committee room.
We voted for Donald Trump, and they're going to remove him because they don't like him. Americans are sick of their impeachment. They're sick of the Democrat treason. We know who committed the crime, but it wasn't Trump. Trump is innocent.
The committee will come to order. Obviously, I shouldn't have to remind everyone present that the audience is here to observe, but not to demonstrate, not to indicate agreement or disagreement with any witness or with any member of the committee. The audience is here to observe only, and we will maintain decorum in the hearing room. And again, I will say, here is how the committee will proceed for this hearing. I will make an opening statement, and then I will recognize the ranking member for an opening statement. After that, we will hear two sets of presentations. We will hear 30-minute opening arguments from counsels for the majority and the minority of this committee. Then we will hear 45-minute presentations of evidence from majority and minority counsel from the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, followed by 45 minutes of questioning by the chair and ranking member, who may yield to counsel for questioning during this period. Finally, all of our members will have the opportunity to question the presenters from the Intelligence Committee under the 5-minute rule. I would note that the President's counsel was given the opportunity to participate today, but the White House has declined the invitation. I will now recognize myself for an opening statement. No matter his party or his politics, if the President places his own interests above those of the country, he betrays his oath of office. The President of the United States, the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader of the Senate, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and the Chairman and ranking members of the House Committee on the Judiciary all have one important thing in common. We have each taken an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. If the President puts himself before the country, he violates the President's most basic responsibility. He breaks his oath to the American people. If he puts himself before the country in a manner that threatens our democracy, then our oath, our promise to the American people, requires us to come to the defense of the nation. That oath stands even when it is politically inconvenient, even when it might bring us under criticism, even when it might cost us our jobs as members of Congress. And even if the President is unwilling to honor his oath, I am compelled to honor mine. As we heard in our last hearing, the framers of the Constitution were careful students of history and clear in their vision for the new nation. They knew that threats to democracy can take many forms, that we must protect against them. They warned us against the dangers of would-be monarchs, fake populists, and charismatic demagogues. They knew that the most dangerous threat to our country might come from within, in the form of a corrupt executive who put his private interests above the interests of the nation. They also knew that they could not anticipate every threat a president might someday pose, so they adopted the phrase treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors to capture the full spectrum of possible presidential misconduct. George Mason, who proposed the standard, said that it was meant to capture all manner of great and dangerous offenses against the Constitution. The debates around the framing make clear that the most serious such offenses include abuse of power, betrayal of the nation through foreign entanglements, and corruption of public office. Any one of these violations of the public trust would compel the members of this committee to take action. When combined in a single course of action, they state the strongest possible case for impeachment and removal from office. President Trump put himself before country. Despite the political partisanship that seems to punctuate our hearings these days, I believe that there is common ground around some of these ideas, common ground in this hearing room and common ground across the country at large. We agree, for example, that impeachment is a solemn, serious undertaking. We agree that it is meant to address serious threats to democratic institutions like our free and fair elections. We agree that when the elections themselves are threatened by enemies foreign or domestic, we cannot wait until the next election to address the threat. We surely agree that no public official, including and especially the President of the United States, should use his public office for private gain. And we agree that no president may put himself before the country. The Constitution and his oath of office, his promise to America's citizens, require the president to put the country first. If we could drop our blinders for just one moment, I think we would agree on a common set of facts as well. On July 25th, President Trump called President Zelensky of Ukraine and asked him for a favor. That call was part of a concerted effort by President Trump to compel the government of Ukraine to announce an investigation, not an investigation of corruption writ large, but an investigation of President Trump's political rivals, and only his political rivals. President Trump put himself before country. The record shows that President Trump withheld military aid allocated by the United States Congress from Ukraine. It also shows that he withheld a White House meeting from President Zelensky. Multiple witnesses, including respected diplomats, national security professionals, and decorated war veterans, all testified to the same basic fact. President Trump withheld the aid and the meeting in order to pressure a foreign government to do him that favor. President Trump put himself before country. And when the president got caught, when Congress discovered that the aid had been withheld from Ukraine, the president took extraordinary and unprecedented steps to conceal evidence from Congress and from the American people. These facts are not in dispute. In fact, most of the arguments about these facts appear to be beside the point. As we review the evidence today, I expect we will hear much about the whistleblower who brought his concerns about the July 25th call to the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community. Let me be clear. Every fact alleged by the whistleblower has been substantiated by multiple witnesses, again and again, each of whom has been questioned extensively by Democrats and Republicans alike. The allegations also match up with the President's own words, as released by the White House, words that he still says were perfect. I also expect to hear complaints about the term quid pro quo, as if a person needs to verbally acknowledge the name of a crime while he is committing it, for it to be a crime at all. The record on this point is also clear. Multiple officials testified that the president's demand for an investigation into his rivals was a part of his personal political agenda and not related to the foreign policy objectives of the United States. Multiple officials testified that the president intended to withhold the aid until Ukraine announced investigations. And yes, multiple officials testified that they understood this arrangement to be a quid pro quo for the president's personal political benefit. President Trump put himself before country. The president's supporters are going to argue that this whole process is unfair. The record before us is clear on this point as well. We invited the president to participate in this hearing, to question witnesses, and to present evidence that might explain the charges against him. President Trump chose not to show. He may not have much to say in his own defense, but he cannot claim that he did not have an opportunity to be heard. Finally, As we proceed today, we will hear a great deal about the speed with which the House is addressing the President's actions. To the members of the committee, to the members of the House, and to my fellow citizens, I want to be absolutely clear. The integrity of our next election is at stake. Nothing could be more urgent. The President welcomed foreign interference in our elections in 2016. He demanded it for 2020. Then he got caught. If you do not believe that he will do it again, let me remind you that the President's personal lawyer spent last week back in Ukraine meeting with government officials in an apparent attempt to gin up the same so-called favors that brought us here today and forced Congress to consider the impeachment of a sitting president. This pattern of conduct represents a continuing risk to the country. The evidence shows that Donald J. Trump, the President of the United States, has put himself before his country. He has violated his most basic responsibilities to the people. He has broken his oath. I will honor mine. If you would honor yours, then I would urge you to do your duty. Let us review the record here in full view of the American people, and then let us move swiftly to defend our country. We promised that we would. I now recognize the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, the gentleman from Georgia,
Mr.
Collins, for his opening statement.
Mr. Chairman, have
the gentleman
unanimous
from Georgia is recognized. The gentleman from Georgia is recognized. Gentleman from Georgia is recognized.
Well, you're not going to recognize a possible motion before me?
Unanimous consent, Mr. Chairman?
Unanimous consent request.
It's unanimous consent request.
The gentleman from Georgia is recognized. We'll entertain that later.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman from Georgia is
recognized. Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
The gentleman will state his point of order.
Mr. Chairman, last week you were furnished with a proper demand for minority hearing pursuant to Clause 2J1 of Rule 11. In a blatant and egregious violation of the rules, you are refusing to schedule that hearing. Therefore, I insist on my point of order unless you are willing to immediately schedule a minority hearing day.
That is not a proper point of order in today's hearing. As I have told the ranking member several times now, I am considering the minority's request.
It's not to be considered,
ranking
Mr. Chairman.
Member, the gentleman will suspend. If the ranking member thinks we would be violating the rules of the House if we considered articles of impeachment before holding a minority day hearing, his point of order would be timely at a meeting where we considered articles of impeachment. That is not the purpose of today's hearing, and the point of order is not timely. The gentleman from Georgia.
Well, that got us started again. The chairman completely not answering a question. It is timely, and it's frankly not up to his discretion, but again, we've not really cared about that from the start to begin with. So my question is just schedule the hearing, but undoubtedly that's not what they want out there. So let's start over. Now that the chairman is recognized and we've got that point. You know, there have been famous moments in impeachment. There have been famous moments in impeachment as we've gone forward. There are famous lines from Nixon like, what did the president know and when did he know it? From the Clinton impeachment, there was, I did not have sex with that woman. What would be known about this one is probably, where's the impeachable offense? Why are we here? I tell you, this may be, though, become known as the focus group impeachment. Because we don't have a crime, we don't have anything we can actually pin, and nobody understands really what the majority is trying to do, except that interfere and basically make sure that they believe the president can't win next year if he's impeached. The focus group impeachment takes words and then takes them to people and say, how can we explain this better? Because we don't have the facts to match it. A focus group impeachment says, you know, we really aren't working with good facts, but we need a good PR move. That's why we're here today. This is all about, as I said last week, a clock and a calendar. And it really became evident to me that this was true because last Wednesday, after we had a long day of hearing here, the next morning, before anything else could get started, the Speaker of the House walked up to the podium and said, go write articles of impeachment. She just quit. She just stopped. Go write articles of impeachment. I appreciate that the majority practiced for 2 days this weekend on this hearing. I appreciate that the fact that you got to try and get it right to try and convince the American people of your problem, but your speaker's already undercut you. She took the thrill out of the room. You're writing articles of impeachment. Why couldn't we just save that time today, and if you're going to write the articles of impeachment, go ahead and write them? Well, there's probably a reason for that. Because the chairman laid out some amazing claims, none of which I think after this hearing today, the American people can honestly look at and see that there is overwhelming evidence, there is a proper reason he abused this power, because as the Speaker, another statement she said, that to do impeachment you have to be so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, all of which we are not. So why not? Why are we here? Well, I think we can do this. Let's look at the three things that typically are associated with making your case for a crime. Let's do it against what the majority has said. I think they have motive, they have means, and they have opportunity. What's their motive? It's November 2020. It's been said over and over and over again. The chairman said it again this morning. It's been said all along that we have to do this because if we don't impeach him, he'll win again next year. The reason is shown as clearly as last week on the jobs report and the economy. And as I had a man come up to me in the grocery store this weekend, he said, keep doing what you're doing. He said, I've never seen an economy this good. He said, people are working, people are being taken care of, and this is just a fatal distraction on a president that they don't like. Motive is easy. November 2016, they lost. January 2017, just a few minutes in, the Washington Post confirmed what every Democrat had been talking about. Now's the time for impeachment. We see tweet after tweet saying, now let's get at it. It's amazing that they start with impeachment and then they spent 2 years trying to figure out what do we impeach him on. Well, the means became what we see now. The means is to always talk about impeachment, to always say this president's doing something wrong, to say he is illegitimate, as the chairman has said before, that he's not even a legitimate president. It's to constantly tear down at a president who is working on behalf of the American people. The sham impeachment, when we go through this, I think the chairman said something that was interesting. He said that a president should not be above the law and should be held accountable for the oath of their office. I think Congress ought to be held accountable for their oath of office as well, and not to do what we're doing right now, and that is run a process that doesn't fit fairness or decorum, to run a process and a fact pattern that you're having to force against a president you don't like. But what was the opportunity? The opportunity came last November when they got the majority and they began their impeachment run. They began in the process, even as selecting the chairman. The chairman said that I would be the best person for impeachment. This is November of last year. Before we had any hearings, before we had even were sworn in to this Congress, for anyone, the media or watching on TV or watching in this room, for anyone to think that this was not a baked deal is not being honest with themselves. You see, presumption has now become the standard instead of proof. It should cause anyone to begin to question, because the entire case is built on a presumption, or as we found out last week from three scholars, that inference is okay. If you just infer that that's what they mean, then we'll take that. That was an interesting line. You know, it was interesting. They made their whole case built on Gordon Sondland. You're going to see that a lot today. He testified that he presumed that the aide was connected to an investigation, but he said nobody ever told him that. When Sondland even asked the president directly, he said, what do you want? The president said, I want nothing. I want Zelensky to do what he ran on. Ukraine did nothing and got the aide anyway. But you know how I know that this is also a problematic experience? Just look over the past 3 weeks. When the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, who, by the way, is absent today, I guess he can't back up his own report, but he started his own hearing by making up the factual call. When he made it up, he started the fairy tale that we're having today. If you can't even put the transcript in the right context, just read it. Chairman Schiff couldn't even read the transcript. He had to make it up, because if he didn't make it up, it didn't sound as bad. It didn't sound as bad. He said, listen, he said, let's make up some dirt. That's not what was said. The transcript, the chairman misled the American people. As an attorney, as a chairman, as a member of Congress who swore an oath to tell, basically, to be honest with the American people and to uphold the Constitution, that was such a massive malpractice I've never seen. Because you know why? Again, they don't care about what actually was in the transcript. They don't actually care what happened. And we heard last week from witnesses, they don't even care that the aid was released. They're simply looking at the facts to make it fit their narrative. But what else happened? You know, this is also the Chairman Schiff who also said that he had seen collusion in plain sight. That it was already there before the Mueller report ever came out, that all of this was going to happen. But you know, I guess maybe I might need to just not stop commenting on Chairman Schiff and his guidance, because I may end up on the next phone records subpoena as we go forward. You see, we've taken a dangerous turn in this Congress. Subpoenas are fine, properly done, and should be done properly, but they should never be at the expense of a political vendetta. Professor Turley testified last week, presumption is no substitute for proof. The current legal case for impeachment is not just woefully inadequate, but in some respects dangerous, and the basis for impeachment of an American president. Today, what we were supposed to get was what I love my friends on the majority of this committee said, Mueller. When we got the Mueller report, it didn't go real well. So we had a lot of hearings, didn't go real well. Then we finally got Bob Mueller, and they said, this is going to be the movie version. In fact, what happened, they did, my colleagues on the majority had live readings from Capitol Hill. They made dramatic podcasts. They even wrote a comic book rendition that breathed life into the Mueller report. And it didn't work. So they brought Bob Mueller. This was the movie version. They told us Robert Mueller's testimony would be the thing that people watched and would be convinced. Guess what? They wasn't convinced. In fact, it fell flat. But you know, today, I guess, is the movie version of the Schiff Report. Except one thing, the star witness failed to show up. Mr. Nunez is here. His staff is here. The leading headline is there, Schiff Report. But where's Mr. Schiff? And Mueller, Robert Mueller testified. The Ken Starr Report, Ken Starr testified. The author of the Schiff Report is not here. Instead, he's sending his staff to do his job for him. I guess that's what you get when you're making up impeachment as you go. So as we look forward here, there's going to be plenty of time to discuss the factual case for this and the statements that are not being made. What is very detrimental to me, though, is this. This committee is not hearing from a factual witness. This committee is not doing anything past hearing from law school professors and staff. We've not been given, the chairman said something about the president not being able to come. Show me where he would actually have a proper process in this that's not talking to staff and not talking to law school professors, when we could actually have witnesses that would be called by both sides. But I want to say this in ending. I love this institution. I was here as a 19-year-old kid, as an intern, almost 32 years ago. This institution, as we see it today, is in danger. We see chairmen who are issuing subpoenas for personal vendettas. We see committees such as the Judiciary Committee that has held many, many substantive hearings, has been the very center point of impeachment, being used as a rubber stamp because we get not our marching orders from this committee and what it should be doing, but from the Speaker and the Intelligence Committee chairman. We're not able to do what we need to do because we're a rubber stamp. I love this institution, but in the last 3 days, over the last three or four days, I've seen stuff that just bother me to no end and should bother everyone. The Speaker of the House, after hearing one day of testimony in the Judiciary Committee, said, go write articles. Facts be damned. Al Green, another member of the House majority, said we can keep impeaching him over and over and over and over again. Adam Schiff, when he told us he wasn't going to come, instead hide behind his staff. He also told us that we're going to keep investigating because they know this is going nowhere in the Senate and they're desperate to have an impeachment vote on this president. The economy is good, job creation is up, military is strong, our country is safe. And the Judiciary Committee has been relegated to this. Why? Because they have the means, they have the motive, and they have the opportunity. And at the end of the day, all this is about is about a clock and a calendar because they can't get over the fact Donald Trump is president of the United States and they don't have a candidate that they think can beat him. It's all political. And as we have talked about before, this is a show. Unfortunately, today, the witness who is supposed to be the star witness chose to take a pass and let a staff answer for him. With that, I yield back.
Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
Thank you, Mr. Collins.
Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
The gentleman will state his point of order.
Mr. Chairman, Clause 2J1 of Rule 11 requires you to schedule a minority hearing day, not to consider it, not to meet to discuss it, but to schedule one, and to schedule it at a reasonable time, not after articles have been drawn, not after there's been a vote on articles of impeachment. I inquire and insist, Mr. Chairman, that you immediately schedule a minority hearing day or tell us why you are ignoring the rules.
The gentleman, we've already gone through that, but I will repeat, that is not a proper point of order in today's hearing. As I've told the ranking minority member several times, I'm considering the minority's request. If you think we would be violating the rules of the House if we considered the articles of impeachment before holding a minority day hearing, that point of order would be timely at a meeting where we considered such articles. It's not the purpose of today's hearing, and the point of order is not in order.
Mr. Chairman, since I've been, indicated in this, I'd like to ask
without objection,
our summons have not
without objection, all other opening statements will be included in the record.
Reserve my point of objection on that.
Okay, the point of objection.
I have a question. You've brought my name into this.
Gentlemen.
You have brought my name into this.
The gentleman will suspend. The gentleman is recognized.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's telling me that you're considering something you have nothing to consider, and you have told me that, I'll admit on record, is nowhere close to actually following your duty as a chairman to follow the rules. And so I think the point of order is very well taken. I think the issue that we have is not, I think your timing is, I mean, show me please in the rule. Have your parliamentarian show me in the rules where you come to a time of actually being able to deny this up at a certain point.
Further reserving the right to object.
I have said the point of order would be in order at the meeting where we are considering articles.
Further reserving the right to object.
We will now hear presentations.
Mr. Chairman, I appeal the decision of the chair.
There's no decision to appeal. There was not a ruling and a motion. We will now hear presentations.
There's a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order.
You made a ruling on the point of order, Mr. Chairman. You can't then not allow us to appeal the ruling of the chair.
The gentleman will suspend.
You do have a ruling.
It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not a cognizable point of order. It was not in order at this time to make that point of order. There is no ruling to appeal.
But Mr. Chairman, it's now, the rule was the obligation, not consideration. You are obligated
to
schedule, not to consider. You made a ruling. It is in order to appeal.
The gentleman will suspend. We are doing what we have to do under the rules. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
Mr. Chairman,
the gentleman is not recognized. We will now hear presentations of evidence.
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
I haven't removed my objection yet.
I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. We will now hear presentations of evidence from counsel to the judiciary.
Is this when we just hear staff ask questions of other staff and the members get dealt out of this whole hearing? And in the next 4 hours, you're going to try to overturn the result of an election with unelected people giving testimony?
The gentleman will suspend. This hearing will be considered in an orderly fashion. The gentleman will not yell out, and he will not attempt to disrupt the proceedings. We will now hear presentations of evidence from counsel to the Judiciary Committee for up to 60 minutes, equally divided.
I've not removed
Barry Burke
my objection
will present,
yet.
Barry Burke will present for the majority, and Steve Lancaster will present for the minority. Each of you will have 30 minutes to present. To help you stay within that time, there is a timing light on your table. When the light switches from green to yellow, you have 1 minute to conclude your testimony. When the light turns red, it signals your time is expired. Mr. Burke, you may begin.
Mr. Chairman, you do realize I've never withdrawn my objection.
Gentlemen will suspend.
I've not withdrawn my objection. You've not talked to my objection. Gentlemen, I want everybody to have an opening statement.
Gentlemen will
suspend. I objected to your opening statement comment. Nothing else.
Mr. Burke is recognized.
Steamroll continues.
Mr. Burke has the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ranking Member Collins, and all the members. Before I had the great honor of being a counsel for this committee, my young son asked me a question. He said, Dad, does the president have to be a good person? Like many questions by young children, it had a certain clarity, but it was hard to answer. I said, Son, it is not a requirement that the president be a good person, but that is the hope. And it is not a requirement that the president be a good person. That is not why we are here today. That is not the issue. But the very document that created the awesome presidency and its powers that we have made clear it is a requirement that the president be a person who does not abuse his power. It is a requirement that the president be a person who does not risk national security of this nation and the integrity of our elections in order to further his own reelection prospects. It is a requirement that the president not be a person who acts as though he is above the law in putting his personal and political interests above the nation's interests. That is the lesson of the Constitution. That is the lesson of the founders. They were concerned that someone would be elected president who would use all the power of that office to serve his own personal interests at the expense of the people who elected him. They decided there needed to be a remedy because they had suffered the abuses of King George, where they had no remedy. The remedy they imposed was that if a president commits a grave offense, a high crime or misdemeanor, this body has the power to impeach that president. They wanted to ensure that a president could not serve his own interests over that of the nation. It flows from the very oath that all members of this body must take to support and defend the Constitution and bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That is why we are here today, and it is an unfortunate occasion that these proceedings are necessary. But the president's actions have left no choice. The founders were very clear in spelling out what they saw to be the greatest abuses that would raise the most concerns for our nation. They spelled them out as warning signals that if a president violated or committed one of these, that would be a reason to potentially impeach that president. They were abuse of power, betrayal of the national interest, corruption of elections. And what is so extraordinary is the conduct we're going to be talking about today of President Trump didn't violate one of these, but all three. First, the evidence is overwhelming that the president abused his power by pressuring Ukraine and its new president to investigate a political opponent. The evidence is overwhelming that the president abused his power by ramping up that pressure, by conditioning a wanted White House meeting and a needed military aid that had been approved in order to get that president to investigate a political rival. It is clear and overwhelming that in abusing that power, the president betrayed the national interest by putting his own political prospects over the national security of our country. It is clear that the president risked corrupting our elections by inviting foreign interference to knock out an adversary to help his prospects in re-election. It is why in debating the Constitution, James Madison warned that because the presidency was to be administered by a single man, his corruption might be fatal to the republic. And the scheme by President Trump was so brazen, so clear, supported by documents, actions, sworn testimony, uncontradicted, contemporaneous records, that it's hard to imagine that anybody could dispute those acts, let alone argue that that conduct does not constitute an impeachable offense or offenses. This is a big deal. President Trump did what a president of our nation is not allowed to do. It is why last week the constitutional scholar Professor Michael Gerhardt said, if what we're talking about is not impeachable, then nothing is impeachable. President Trump's actions are impeachable offenses. They threaten our rule of law. They threaten our institutions. And as James Madison warned us, they threaten our republic. Let me begin where we must, with the facts and evidence. First, it's important to understand why Ukraine was so important to our national security. Ukraine was under attack by its aggressive and hostile neighbor, Russia. They had already encroached on its territories. The Ukraine was at great risk that Russia would again take further territory or try. Europe had a stake in this, and so did we. I'm going to turn to an expert on this, Ambassador Taylor, who is one of the most highly decorated diplomats and recognized diplomats for over 40 years. He served our country honorably, and he was appointed by President Trump himself to be in charge of the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine.
The Russians are violating all of the rules, treaties, understandings that they committed to that actually kept the peace in Europe for nearly 70 years. That rule of law, that order, that kept the peace in Europe and allowed for prosperity as well as peace in Europe was violated by the Russians. It affects the world that we live in, that our children will grow up in, and our grandchildren. This affects the kind of world that we want to see abroad.
That is Ambassador Taylor explaining why Ukraine was so important and explaining why the president's actions so significantly risk hurting our national security, our national defense policy, and our national interest. Now, you've already heard there is significant proof that President Trump himself told the new president of Ukraine, President Zelensky, that he wanted him to investigate a political rival, former Vice President Joe Biden. And you'll hear a lot about that today. But that proof is only the tip of the iceberg. There are so many more events and meetings and contemporaneous text messages, emails, other documents that show this happened and happened exactly as it is alleged. And it is clear that in this scheme to pressure Ukraine to investigate a political rival, the person at the center of that scheme was President Donald Trump. The facts cannot be disputed. President Trump used the powers of government for a domestic political errand to put his political interests above that of the nation. I'm going to turn to another expert. I'm going to turn to Dr. Fiona Hill, the National Security Council Senior Director in the Trump administration, and she's going to explain what happened.
But it struck me one yesterday when you put up on the screen Ambassador Sondland's emails and who was on these emails, and he said these are the people who need to know that he was absolutely right, because he was being involved in a domestic political errand. And we were being involved in national security foreign policy, and those two things had just diverged.
And that tells you what the evidence shows. The president put his own domestic political interests over the nation's national security and foreign policy. A president cannot abuse his power to secure an election. He cannot do that at the expense of the American people. That is an impeachable offense. The president has tried to make excuses for his conduct, why it's not wrongful or corrupt or an abuse of power. But the truth holds together. It makes sense. It's consistent with the evidence. When someone is offering an excuse that is not true, it is not consistent with the evidence. It does not make sense. It cannot be squared with what the facts show. And you will see these excuses do not make sense. The facts are clear that President Trump put his own political and personal interests over the nation's interest. I'd like to go through what you are going to see about the president's scheme and you're going to hear about today from the facts that we have. First, you're going to hear that President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, pushed Ukraine to open an investigation of his political rival. Mr. Giuliani, prior to the July 25th call, he made public statements that Ukraine should investigate the former Vice President Joe Biden. He tweeted about it, putting pressure on the new president. He went to Ukraine and later went again with the assist and direction of U.S. officials who were told to aid the president's personal lawyer on the president's behalf. You'll hear that President Trump told his aides that he was relying on for Ukraine that he wanted them to, quote, talk to Rudy. What you're going to hear is that his close advisors had just gotten back on May 23rd from the inauguration of the new president, President Zelensky. They told President Trump, we were impressed. He was elected on an anti-corruption platform, a reform platform. You should schedule a White House meeting. It's very important. This is very good for the United States. And the president's response was, talk to Rudy, who had been out there claiming what the Ukrainian president had to do was investigate his political rival. You'll hear that President Trump's advisors told President Zelensky that President Trump would not schedule the wanted White House meeting unless he announced a Ukrainian investigation of former Vice President Biden. There are documents, there's sworn testimony. This happened, and there is no question from the evidence that the president did this. And President Zelensky desperately needed a White House meeting, both to show Russia that the U.S. was still supporting Ukraine and for his own credibility as a new president. You'll hear then, to ramp up the pressure, what President Trump did is he told his agencies to withhold military and security aid that had been approved and was supposed to be released to Ukraine, hundreds of millions of dollars, in order to put more pressure on Ukraine. All the agencies involved, State Department, Defense Department, National Security Council, said it should be released. It had been approved. It was going to be released until President Trump personally stopped it. And again, contemporaneous evidence and documents show it and prove it. People said that they were shocked. Ambassador Taylor said he was in astonishment. A witness said that it was illogical to do this, and the president never offered an explanation. But ultimately, it was discovered why he did it. Then on the July 25th call, President Trump explicitly told him he wanted him to do two Ukrainian investigations, one of a U.S. citizen and his political rival, and the other about the origins of the interference in the 2016 election, some conspiracy theory that Russia, who all the intelligence agencies agreed, interfered with the 2016 election, that maybe it was Ukraine. Again, another investigation intended to help the president politically. That is it. And you know the president cared about the investigations that would help him politically and not Ukraine and not the national security interest. And you don't have to take my word. I'm going to play something from David Holmes, who had worked in the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine and was speaking to Ambassador Sondland, who President Trump appointed. Ambassador Sondland had just come to the Ukraine on the 26th. He met with President Zelensky. He went to a restaurant with Mr. Holmes, the U.S. political affairs counselor in Ukraine. And he called President Trump on his cell phone, and Mr. Holmes could hear that call, and then he spoke to Mr. Sondland. Let's see what happened on July 26th, the day after that call.
I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation. Ambassador Sondland replied that he's going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do.
That is sworn testimony by David Holmes, who heard it from the president himself. And it was clear to everyone, the most experienced people in government, who Donald Trump himself appointed in their positions, they knew what was going on. Let's look at a text message from Ambassador Taylor around this time on September 9th. He said, as I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign. Again, that is President Trump putting his own political and personal interests over the nation's interests to hold aid desperately needed by Ukraine in order to combat Russia and show the support. He did it to help his own campaign. Now, there have been excuses offered by the president. I'd like to briefly talk about those excuses. The first excuse offered by President Trump is that the aid was ultimately released and President Trump met with Mr. Zelensky. We heard it today. The challenge with that, though, as an excuse, is the aid was only released after President Trump got caught doing the scheme. On September 9th, the committees of this House started their investigation and announced they were investigating his conduct with regard to Ukraine. 2 days later was when he released the aid. And there also was a news article, which we'll talk about in a moment, by the Washington Post on September 5th, exposing his scheme. And it was only after that he met with President Zelensky, not in the White House, but in New York. Another excuse offered: the president was motivated by general corruption concerns. And again, the evidence shows that is not true, that that's what caused him to withhold the aid. President Zelensky, in fact, was elected on an anti-corruption platform. He was a reform candidate. His own people told him again and again, President Zelensky is a hope. He's doing it the right way. They urged him to be supportive. On his call with President Zelensky on July 25th, President Trump ignored the talking points that were prepared to talk about corruption. He only wanted to talk about two things, the two investigations that helped him politically. Every intelligence agency unanimously supported releasing the aid to Ukraine. That was appropriate. They did a study, a corruption study. They said, release it. The White House never provided an explanation. The aid had already been approved, and it was not for any corruption issues that President Trump withheld it. The next is Ukraine was not pressured. And the argument about that is, well, today they haven't said they were pressured. Well, Ukraine was pressured then and still is pressured. They are desperately in need of the United States support as they battle the threat of Russia. So, of course, they have to be careful what they said. But contemporaneous documents, emails, texts from the Ukrainian officials themselves show the pressure they felt, showed they knew what the President Trump was doing, showed what they had to do. This is one from Bill Taylor to, again, Ambassador Gordon Sondland and Ambassador Kurt Volker. Gordon, one thing Kurt and I talked about yesterday was Sasha Danilak, a senior aide of President Zelensky's, point that President Zelensky is sensitive about Ukraine being taken seriously, not merely an instrument in Washington domestic re-election politics. They not only felt the pressure, they got the message. They were not going to get a White House meeting. They were ultimately not going to get military aid unless they furthered President Trump's re-election efforts. That is a corrupt abuse of power. Another argument that's made is that Trump never said quid pro quo. And what you're going to hear is on a call with Ambassador Sondland after a Washington Post article came out on September 5th, which we will look at. After that, there was a Washington Post article that came out that, again, exposed the Ukrainian scheme. Days after that, President Trump was on a phone call with Ambassador Sondland and without prompting said there was no quid pro quo because he got caught. So he's offering his defense. But even Ambassador Sondland in his sworn testimony didn't buy it because ultimately then President Trump not only was not dissuaded, he again described what he wanted. He didn't want Ukraine to actually conduct these investigations. He wanted them to announce investigations of his political rival to help him politically. He continued, and you'll hear more about that. Again, none of these excuses hold any water, and they are refuted by testimony, contemporaneous records, and more. Now, some have suggested that we should wait to proceed with these impeachment proceedings, because we've not heard from all of the witnesses or obtained all the documents. But the reason we have not heard from all the witnesses or documents is because President Trump himself has obstructed the investigation. He's directed his most senior aides who are involved in some of these events not to come testify, to defy subpoenas. He has told every one of his agencies with records that could be relevant not to produce those records to us, to try to obstruct our investigation. Now, this is evidence that President Trump is replaying the playbook used in the prior Department of Justice investigation. In that investigation, he directed his White House counsel to create a false, phony record and document and lie, denying that President Trump had told him to fire the special counsel. He did many other things to try to interfere with that investigation. He attacked the investigators and witnesses and called them horrible names, just as he has done here. And President Trump thought he got away with it. On July 24th was the day that the special counsel testified before this committee and the House Intelligence Committee. The 24th. It was exactly the following day, the 25th, that President Trump spoke to President Zelensky in furtherance of his Ukrainian scheme. He thought he got away with it. Not only that, he thought he could use his powers to interfere with that investigation so he could do what he wanted. He could act like he was above the law. And if he got caught, he would again use his powers to try to obstruct the investigation and prevent the facts from coming out. And that's exactly what he did. But fortunately, because of the true American patriots who came forward to testify despite the threats by President against the people who worked in his own administration, they told the story. They, on their own, produced documents that provide uncontroverted, clear, and overwhelming evidence that President Trump did this scheme. He put his political re-election interests over the nation's national security and the integrity of its elections. He did it intentionally. He did it corruptly. He abused his powers in ways that the founders feared the most. No person in this country has the ability to prevent investigations, and neither does the president. Our Constitution does not allow it. No one is above the law, not even the president. And one of the concerns and requirements of finding an impeachable offense, is there an urgency? Is there a sense that you have to move because it could be repeated? Well, again, first, all the constitutional experts who testified recognized that obstructing an investigation is an impeachable offense. But here, the offense we're talking about that's being interfered or obstructed with is interfering with this very election that's coming up. And I submit to you, given what happened with the Department of Justice investigation, given what's happening here, if, in fact, President Trump can get away with what he did again, our imagination is the only limit to what President Trump may do next or what a future president may do next to try to abuse his or her power to serve his own personal interest over the nation's interest. I'd like to turn back to what the founders most cared about. We talk about the ABCs of potential presidential abuses. It is extraordinary that the president's conduct was a trifecta, checking all three boxes. Let's begin with abuse of power. What that means, it's to use the power of the office to obtain an improper personal benefit while ignoring or injuring the national interest, or acts in ways that are grossly inconsistent with and undermine the separation of powers that is the foundation of our democratic system. Now, this question of whether a president engaged in abuse of power came up before when this Congress considered the impeachment of President Nixon. And after action was taken, President Nixon famously said, if the president does it, it is not illegal. And this body rejected that because that's not so. That goes directly contrary to what the founder said. But President Trump has said the same thing in responding to the prior investigation by Department of Justice and defending his conduct. Here's what he said.
Then I have an Article 2 where I have the right to do whatever I want as president.
That he has the right to do whatever he wants as president. That is as wrong as when President Nixon said a similar thing. That is not what the Constitution provides. That is not what the country demands. He does not have the right to do whatever he wants. Turning to the second abuse of power most concerned, betrayal of the nation involving foreign powers. The American people have suffered that foreign influence when President Trump treated military aid that had been approved taxpayers' dollars and decided to treat it as his own checkbook to try to further his own reelection chances. That reflects what the founders were concerned about. And finally, corruption of our elections. The framers knew that corrupt leaders, or leaders acting corruptly, concentrate their powers to manipulate elections and undercut adversaries. They talked about it frequently. That is why the framers thought electoral treachery, particularly involving foreign powers, was a critical abuse and that could support and lead to impeachment. Now, the American people learned last election how dangerous foreign intervention in our elections can be. Let me show another clip from President, from candidate Trump on the campaign trail.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
And Russia was listening. Within approximately 5 hours, 5 hours of President Trump's invitation to Russia to interfere in our election by trying to hack and obtain the emails of his political opponent, Russia, in fact, tried to do that for the first time. The very officers who were then indicted by the Department of Justice for that conduct, they took candidate Trump's invitation. Now, The American people learned a lesson. President Trump, unfortunately, apparently learned a different lesson. Let's look.
Well, I would think that if they were honest about it, they'd start a major investigation into the Biden. It's a very simple answer. They should investigate the Biden.
So this was President Trump answering a question about what did he want President Zelensky to do. So even after he got caught, he is saying, again, this vulnerable nation, dependent on U.S. support militarily and otherwise, again, he's telling them what to do. And unlike in 2016, when he only had a campaign platform, which to extend the invitation to a foreign power, now he has the levers of government in his control to not only request it and invite it, but to pressure that country to do it. And that's exactly what he did. And you'll hear more about that in the presentation from the House Intelligence Committee. And what's most striking as we come back to this issue that the framers were concerned about, is there a continuing risk of wrongdoing? The fact that President Trump did this after he was caught shows the risk. Shows the risk of what will happen if this body doesn't act. He really does believe he can act as though he were above the law. He really does believe, as evidenced by this conduct, that he can put his personal and political interests over the nation's interest, over the nation's national security interest, over the nation's integrity of its elections. So, of course, we do have an election coming up. That's not a reason to postpone this discussion. That's a reason we must have this discussion, to make sure it is not interfered with, to make sure this president doesn't do it, to make sure future presidents do not do it. It is the hope that in these discussions we can put aside political rancor, disagreements, and have a fair discussion about the facts and this conduct. Not just as it relates to President Trump, but as to the presidency itself and future presidents. My son, our children, our grandchildren, they will study this moment in history. They will read all of your remarks. They will learn about all of your actions. And that is not a reason to vote for or against impeachment. For that, of course, you must vote your conscience. But that is a reason for us to have a fair debate about what the undisputed facts show. To recognize that it is wrong, it is very wrong, and it cannot happen again with this president or any president. It is a reason to talk about whether we want our children and grandchildren to live in a country where the president elected by the people can put his own personal and political interests over the interests of the people who elected them. It is a reason for these debates to, again, fairly focus on the facts and to make sure the presentations we're going to hear will not distort the record, focus on process points, raise extraneous matters that really are intended to distract rather than focus on what the conduct was at issue here. It is a reason to focus on the facts and what is in the country's best interest. History, future generations will be the judge.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Castor, you
Mr.
are,
Chairman. Mr.
You are recognized for 30 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Mr. Castor is recognized for 30 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, point of order.
Mr. Castor is recognized for 30 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, the witness has violated Rule 17, and my point of order should be heard.
Point of order.
The witness has used language which impugns the motives of the president and suggests he's disloyal to his country, and those words should be stricken from the record and taken down.
The point of order is not sustained. Witnesses are not subject to the rules of decorum.
Appeal the ruling of the chair.
In the same way, members are. The topic of the hearing is the president's misconduct, so none of us should find it surprising that we are hearing testimony that is critical of the president. I do not find that the witness's comments are disorderly. I find they are pertinent to the subject matter of this hearing. The witness would be able to continue, except that his time has expired. Mr. Castor is
Mr.
recognized.
Chairman, it's not...
The gentleman
Mr.
will suspend.
Chairman, my point of order is not that his words are disorderly. They are unparliamentary. They violate the rules of the House. He should be taken down. This is not about his conduct. He's talking about the motives
the
and
suspend.
The character of the President
the gentleman
of the United
will
States.
Suspend. The rules of decorum apply to members of the House, not to witnesses. The gentleman may proceed.
So, I appeal the ruling of the chair.
That is not a ruling.
It is a ruling on a point of order. It's appealable.
That is a ruling.
Subject to a vote.
And that's a rule.
The point of order is not sustained.
Appeals the ruling of the chair.
Appeals the ruling of the chair.
I move to table the
motion is made to table the appeal of the ruling of the chair. The motion
move the motion to table is made in writing. Move the motion is made
motion table
in writing.
Motion table is not in debate. Is not all in favor of the motion to table. All in favor of the motion to table will say aye. Opposed, no. No. The motion to table.
She has to put it in writing first. Then you can call the vote.
Motion to table is.
At least you're following the rules.
Motion to table. Is sustained.
Roll call.
The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Nadler?
Aye.
Mr. Nadler votes aye. Ms. Lofgren?
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye. Ms. Jackson Lee?
Aye.
Ms. Jackson Lee votes aye. Mr. Cohen?
Aye.
Mr. Cohen votes aye. Mr. Johnson of Georgia?
Aye.
Mr. Johnson of Georgia votes aye. Mr. Deutsch? Mr. Deutsch votes aye. Ms. Bass? Ms. Bass votes aye. Mr. Richmond?
Aye.
Mr. Richmond votes aye. Mr. Jeffries?
Aye.
Mr. Jeffries votes aye. Mr. Cicilline?
Aye.
Mr. Cicilline votes aye. Mr. Swalwell?
Aye.
Mr. Swalwell votes aye. Mr. Liu?
Aye.
Mr. Liu votes aye. Mr. Raskin?
Aye.
Mr. Raskin votes aye. Ms. Jayapal?
Aye.
Ms. Jayapal votes aye. Ms. Stemming?
Aye.
Ms. Demings votes aye. Mr. Correa?
Aye.
Mr. Correa votes aye. Ms. Scanlon?
Aye.
Ms. Scanlon votes aye. Ms. Garcia?
Aye.
Ms. Garcia votes aye. Mr. Neguse?
Aye.
Mr. Neguse votes aye. Ms. McBath?
Aye.
Ms. McBath votes aye. Mr. Stanton?
Aye.
Mr. Stanton votes aye. Ms. Dean?
Aye.
Ms. Dean votes aye. Ms. McCarsel-Powell?
Aye.
Ms. McCarsel-Powell votes aye. Ms. Escobar?
Aye.
Ms. Escobar votes aye. Mr. Collins?
Nope.
Mr. Collins votes no. Mr. Sensenbrenner?
Nope.
Mr. Sensenbrenner votes no. Mr. Shabbat?
No.
Mr. Shabbat votes no. Mr. Gohmert?
No.
Mr. Gohmert votes no. Mr. Jordan?
No.
Mr. Jordan votes no. Mr. Buck? Mr. Ratcliffe?
No.
Mr. Ratcliffe votes no. Ms. Roby? Ms. Roby votes no. Mr. Gates?
No.
Mr. Gates votes no. Mr. Johnson of Louisiana?
No.
Mr. Johnson of Louisiana votes no. Mr. Biggs? Mr. McClintock?
No.
Mr. McClintock votes no. Ms. Lesko?
No.
Ms. Lesko votes no. Mr. Reschenthaler? Mr. Klein?
No.
Mr. Klein votes no. Mr. Armstrong?
No.
Mr. Armstrong votes no. Mr. Stubbe?
No.
Mr. Stubbe votes no.
Mr. Chairman, how am I recorded?
Mr. Biggs, you are not recorded.
He said no.
Mr. Biggs votes no.
Has every member voted who wishes to vote? The clerk will report.
Got it.
15 no's. Mr. Chairman, there are 24 ayes and 15 no's.
Motion to table is carried.
Mr. Chairman, parliamentary inquiry. May I make a parliamentary inquiry?
Mr. Castor is recognized. I will not recognize a parliamentary inquiry at this time. Mr. Castor is recognized for 30 minutes.
Good morning, Chairman Nadler, Ranking Member Collins, members of the committee, and members of the staff. My name is Steve Castor. I'm a congressional staff member. I serve with the Oversight Committee on the Republican staff with Mr. Jordan. I'm also, for purposes of this investigation, I'm a shared staffer with the Judiciary Committee and Mr. Collins and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and Mr. Nunes. It sure is atypical for a staffer to be presenting, but again, thanks for having me. The purpose of this hearing, as we understand it, is to discuss whether President Donald J. Trump's conduct fits the definition of a high crime and misdemeanor. It does not. Such that the committee should consider articles of impeachment to remove the president from office, and it should not. This case, in many respects, comes down to 8 lines in a call transcript. Let me say clearly and unequivocally that the answer to that question is no. The record in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry does not show that President Trump abused the power of his office or obstructed Congress. To impeach a president who 63 million people voted for over 8 lines in a call transcript is baloney. Democrats seek to impeach President Trump not because they have evidence of high crimes or misdemeanors, but because they disagree with his policies. This impeachment inquiry is not the organic outgrowth of serious misconduct. Democrats have been searching for a set of facts on which to impeach President Trump since his inauguration on January 20th, 2017. Just 27 minutes after the president's inauguration that day, the Washington Post ran a story that the campaign to impeach the president has already begun. The article reported Democrats and liberal activists are mounting broad opposition to stymieing Trump's agenda, and noted that impeachment strategists believe the Constitution's Emoluments Clause would be the vehicle. In the first 2 years of the administration, Democrats in the House introduced articles of impeachment to remove President Trump from office on several very different factual bases. On January 3rd, the very first day of the new Congress, Congressman Sherman introduced articles of impeachment against the president. The same day, Representative Tlaib said, we're going to go in there, we're going to impeach the president. In May 2019, Representative Green said on MSNBC, if we don't impeach this president, he will be reelected. Even Speaker Pelosi, who has said that impeachment is a somber and prayerful exercise, has called President Trump an imposter and said it is dangerous to allow voters to judge his performance in 2020. The obsession with impeaching the president is reflected in how House Democrats have used the power of their majority in the past 11 months. In the Oversight Committee, the Democrats' first announced witness was Michael Cohen, a disgraced felon who pleaded guilty to lying to Congress. When he came before us at the Oversight Committee, he then lied again as many as 8 times. Oversight Committee Democrats demanded information about the president's personal finances and even subpoenaed the president's accounting firm, Mazars, for large swaths of sensitive and personal financial information about the entire Trump family. The subpoena was issued over the objection of committee Republicans and without a vote. In the Ways and Means Committee, Democrats demanded the president's personal tax return information. The reason they cited for wanting the president's tax returns, they said, was to oversee the IRS's audit process for presidential tax returns. You can judge that for yourself. In the Financial Services Committee, Democrats demanded and subpoenaed the president's bank records going back 10 years. The Financial Services Committee staff, the Republicans, tell me the information demanded would cover every withdrawal, credit card swipe, or debit card purchase of every member of the Trump family, including his minor child. The reason that the Democrats gave for why they needed such voluminous and intrusive personal information about the Trump family was, get this, financial industry compliance with banking statutes and regulations. Here in the Judiciary Committee, Democrats sent out letters demanding information from over 80 recipients, including the president's children, business partners, employees, his campaign, businesses, and foundation. Of course, the main event for the Judiciary Committee was the report of Special Counsel Mueller, which Democrats would believed would serve as the evidentiary basis for impeaching the president. Despite interviewing 500 witnesses, issuing 2,800 subpoenas, executing almost 500 search warrants, and spending $25 million, the special counsel's 19 attorneys and 40 FBI agents, analysts, and staff found no conspiracy or coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. After the Trump-Russia collusion allegations did not pan out, Democrats focused their efforts on obstruction of justice. They criticized Attorney General Barr for concluding that no crime of obstruction had occurred in the special counsel investigation. But in fact, it was entirely appropriate for the Attorney General to make that call because the special counsel declined to do so. Not surprisingly, the Democrats' Mueller hearing was underwhelming, to say the least. And the sequel with Corey Lewandowski definitely did not move the impeachment needle either. The Intelligence Committee, too, was heavily invested in the Russia collusion investigation. Committee Democrats hired former federal prosecutors to prepare for their anticipated efforts to impeach the president. Now that the Russian collusion allegations did not work out, Democrats have settled on the Ukraine phone call, eight lines the president uttered on July 25th with Ukrainian President Zelensky. But the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Committee of Jurisdiction, wasn't the committee leading the impeachment inquiry or holding the hearings. Neither was the Oversight Committee, the House's chief investigative entity. The Judiciary Committee was only recently brought back into the mix after fact-finding concluded. Instead, the impeachment inquiry was run by the House Intelligence Committee and these former federal prosecutors. Democrats on the Intelligence Committee ran the impeachment inquiry in a manifestly unfair way. All the fact-finding was unclassified, and that was made clear at the top of every single deposition, but the Democrats took advantage of the closed-door process in the Capitol basement bunker, the SCIF, to control access to information. The secrecy effectively weaponized the investigation, allowing misleading public narratives to form and catch hold with careful leaks of witness testimony. Democrats refused to invite Republican witnesses and directed witnesses called by the Democrats not to answer our questions. In the public hearings, many of these unfair processes continued. Democrats refused to invite numerous witnesses requested by Republicans, interrupted Republican questioning, and prevented witnesses from answering Republican questions. Democrats voted down by virtue of a motion to table with no notice subpoenas for documents and testimony requested by Republicans. I'll note that Democrats never once brought any of their subpoenas to a vote before the Intelligence Committee. This unfair process reflects the degree to which Democrats are obsessed with impeaching the president. The Democrats went searching for a set of facts on which to impeach the president: the emoluments clause, the president's business and financial records, the Mueller report, allegations of obstruction, before landing on the Ukraine phone call. The impeachment inquiry is clearly an orchestrated effort to upend our political system. According to Politico, the speaker has tightly scripted every step of the impeachment inquiry. Democrats have reportedly convened focus groups to test which allegations, whether it be quid pro quo or bribery or extortion, were most compelling to the American public. Speaker Pelosi said Democrats must strike while the iron is hot on impeaching the president. The entire duration of the impeachment inquiry, from the time Speaker Pelosi announced it on September 24th until today, has been 76 days. As Professor Turley testified last Wednesday, this impeachment would stand out among modern impeachments as the shortest proceeding with the thinnest evidentiary record and the narrowest grounds ever used to impeach a president. The artificial and arbitrary political deadline by which Democrats are determined to finish impeachment by Christmas leads to a rushed process and missed opportunities to obtain relevant information. Democrats avoided the accommodations process required by federal courts in disputes between Congress and the executive. Democrats declined to attempt to negotiate with the administration for the production of documents and witnesses. Democrats did not exhaust all their options to entice witnesses or agencies to cooperate, such as allowing witnesses to appear with agency lawyers or initiating contempt proceedings. Sometimes the threat of a contempt proceeding gets you a different result. Sometimes the witnesses choose to appear when contempt is on the table. Democrats even withdrew a subpoena to one witness who asked a federal court to resolve conflicting orders from Congress and the executive, either because the Democrats did not want to wait for the court to rule or they didn't like the presiding judge, Judge Leon. Instead, Democrats made their demands and refused to budge. Democrats told witnesses at the outset that their refusal to cooperate in full would be used against them and the president. Democrats threatened federal employees that their salaries could be withheld for not meeting committee demands. These tactics are fundamentally unfair and counterproductive for gathering information in any serious inquiry. This rushed and take-it-or-leave-it approach to investigating is contrary to how successful congressional investigations typically work. Congressional investigations take time. There is no easy button. In this job, you must take the information that's offered, even if you don't like the terms. You should not say no to taking a witness's testimony because you would prefer the agency counsel's not present. If that's the only means of obtaining the testimony, you should take it. Your priority must not be on blocking information out. It must be on seeking information. In all recent major congressional investigations, for example, Chairman Goodlatte and Gowdy's investigation into the Justice Department's decision during 2016, the IRS targeting investigation, the Benghazi investigation, and Fast and Furious, there have been give and take between Congress and the executive. In the Goodlatte-Gowdy investigation, for example, it took 2 months. 2 months of negotiations before the committees conducted the first witness interview with Deputy Director McCabe. The Justice Department only began producing documents to the committee after many more months of discussions. In none of these investigations did Congress get everything it wanted right at the beginning, certainly not within 60 or 76 days, but with persistence and patience, we eventually did receive enough information to do our work. And contrary to talking points, the Trump administration has in fact cooperated with and facilitated congressional oversight and investigations. For example, earlier this year, the Oversight Committee conducted an investigation into security clearances at the White House. The central allegation put forward was that the White House deviated from established procedures to grant clearances to certain White House staff. The Democrats sought to interview career staff who performed these security clearance reviews, but declined the witness initially to appear with agency counsel. The House and the White House were at an impasse. However, after a little bit of time, we, the Republican staff, with the help of Mr. Jordan, convinced the witness to appear with agency counsel for our own transcribed interview, and the Democrats came along. The subsequent interviews in the security clearance investigation were conducted with agency counsel. The testimony allowed the committee to obtain the evidence to get to the bottom of what was going on, and it wasn't what was alleged. Nobody outside the security clearance office was handing out clearances. Certainly not to senior White House staffers. In this impeachment inquiry, however, Democrats have turned away information that could be valuable to the inquiry by disallowing agency counsel to accompany witnesses. Democrats have turned away information by declining to negotiate in good faith with the administration about the scope of document requests. As a result of these failures, the evidentiary record in the impeachment inquiry is incomplete and in many places incoherent. The failure to exhaust all avenues to obtain information severely risks undermining the legitimacy of any articles of impeachment. As Professor Turley said to the committee last week, I'm concerned about lowering impeachment standards to fit a paucity of evidence and an abundance of anger. I believe this impeachment not only fails the standard of past impeachments, but would create a dangerous precedent for future impeachments. Professor Turley elaborated that the current lack of proof is another reason why the abbreviated investigation into this matter is so damaging for the case of impeachment. The substantive case for impeaching President Trump as a result of an artificial, arbitrary, and political schedule relies heavily on ambiguous facts, presumptions, and speculation. President Turley warned here, too, that impeachments have been based on proof, not presumptions. The Democrats do not have the proof. Now, my Democrat counterparts on the Intelligence Committee are talented attorneys. I'm sure they will tell you a riveting story about a shadow or irregular foreign policy apparatus and a smear campaign designed to extort Ukraine for the president's political benefit. They'll tell you about President Trump and how he put his own political interests ahead of national security by mentioning former Vice President Joe Biden by name and raising the allegations of Ukrainian influence in the 2016 election on the July 25th call. They'll try to convince you that the Trump administration, the same administration Democrats regularly accuse of being incompetent, orchestrated an international conspiracy at the highest levels. None of this adds up. It may be a great screenplay, but it's not what the evidence shows. The Democrats' impeachment inquiry ignores all of the evidence that does not advance their story. The Democrats' impeachment narrative resolves all ambiguous facts and conflicting evidence in a way that is most unflattering to the president. The Democrats' impeachment narrative ignores public statements from senior Ukrainian officials that contradict the narrative. As you listen to the Democrat presentation later today, I urge you to keep these points in mind. What evidence that has been gathered in the impeachment inquiry paints a different picture. I won't provide a detailed presentation now, but allow me to highlight a few points. First, the summary of the July 25th phone call reflects no conditionality or pressure. President Zelensky never vocalized any discomfort or pressure on the call. Contrary to Democrat allegations, President Trump was not asking for a favor that would help his reelection. He was asking for assistance in helping our country move forward from the divisiveness of the Russia collusion investigation. Second, since President Trump has declassified and publicly released the call summary 75 days ago, President Zelensky has said publicly and repeatedly that he felt no pressure. He said it on September 25th at the United Nations General Assembly. He said it in an interview published on October 6th. He said it again on October 10th. And most recently, he said it just last week in Time magazine. Other senior Ukrainian officials have also said there was no linkage between a meeting, security assistance, and an investigation. If President Trump was truly orchestrating a pressure campaign to force Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Biden, one would think that Ukraine would have felt some pressure. Third, at the time of the July 25th call, senior officials in Kyiv did not know that the security assistance was paused. They did not learn it was paused until the pause was reported publicly in the U.S. media on August 28th. As Ambassador Volker testified, because the highest levels of the Ukrainian government did not know about the pause, there was no leverage implied. Finally, President Zelensky met with President Trump in New York on September 25th at the United Nations. Shortly thereafter, or shortly before that, the security assistance flowed to Ukraine. Both happened without Ukraine ever taking actions or investigations. The impeachment record also has substantial evidence going to the president's state of mind, undercutting the Democrats' assertion of some malicious intent. Witnesses testified that President Trump has a deeply rooted, genuine, and reasonable skepticism of Ukraine stemming from its history of corruption. President Trump is skeptical of U.S. taxpayer-funded foreign assistance and believes that our allies should share more of the burden of Ukraine's defense. Ukrainian politicians openly spoke out against President Trump during the 2016 election. These events bear directly on the president's state of mind. President Zelensky had run on an anti-corruption platform, but he was an untried politician with a relationship to a controversial Ukrainian oligarch. When former Vice President Pence met with President Zelensky in Warsaw, when Vice President Pence met with President Zelensky in Warsaw on September 1, he stressed to him the need for reform and reiterated the president's concern about burden sharing, especially among European allies. In late August and early September, after his party took control of the Ukrainian parliament, Ukraine passed historic reforms to fight corruption. These reforms including removing parliamentary immunity, which witnesses said had been a historic source of corruption. Imagine if members of our Congress had immunity. President Trump later lifted the pause on security assistance and met with President Zelensky 2 weeks later. The aid was paused for 55 days. Very simply, the evidence in the Democrats' impeachment inquiry does not support the conclusion that President Trump abused his power for his own personal political benefit. There is simply no clear evidence that President Trump acted with malicious intent in withholding a meeting or security assistance. Indeed, there are, and the Republican report articulates them, legitimate explanations for these actions that are not nefarious, as the Democrats allege. The evidence shows that President Trump faithfully executed the duties of his office by delivering on what he promised the American voters he would do. Democrats may disagree with the president's policy decisions or the manner in which he governs, but those disagreements are not enough to justify the irrevocable action of removing him from office. The Democrats' hyperbole and histrionics are no good reason, 11 months out from an election, to prevent the American people from deciding on their own who is going to be their next president. This record also does not support a conclusion that President Trump obstructed Congress during the impeachment inquiry for many of the procedural defects I touched on earlier. Additionally, as a factual matter, the only direct testimony the investigation has obtained about the president's reaction to the inquiry is from Ambassador Sondland, who testified President Trump told him to cooperate and tell the truth. President Trump has also declassified and released the summaries of his two phone calls with the president, President Zelensky. President Trump has said that he would like witnesses to testify, but he's been forced to resist the unfair and abusive process. I believe strongly in the prerogatives of the Congress. It's awful to hear President Turley's testimony from last week when he critiqued the House for proceeding on impeachment so rapidly and on such a thin record. Professor Turley said to set this abbreviated schedule, demand documents, and then impeach because they haven't been turned over when they go to court, I think is an abuse of power. The impeachment of a duly elected president, as Chairman Nadler said in 1998, is the undoing of a national election. Now, I understand Democrats issued a report over the weekend arguing that contrary to the chairman's statement in 1998, impeachment is not undoing it, an election. I would just respond by saying that I don't think many of the 63 million Americans from all around the country who voted for President Trump in 2016 would agree. By impeaching President Trump, the House would essentially be nullifying the decision of those Americans. And the House would be doing it less than 11 months before the next election. There still is no compelling argument for why Democrats in the House must take this decision out of the hands of the voters and do it before Christmas. During the Clinton impeachment in 1998, the chairman said that at bare minimum, the president's accusers must go beyond hearsay and innuendo and beyond the demands that the president prove his innocence of vague and changing charges. I would submit that those words ring as true today as the chairman believed them to be in 1998. The impeachment record is heavily reliant on hearsay, innuendo, and presumptions. Democrats have lobbed vague and ever-changing charges for impeachment going as far back as the president's inauguration. For all these reasons, the extraordinary exercise of the House's impeachment authority is not warranted on the evidentiary record presented. Thank you for allowing me to present this information this morning, and I yield back.
The gentleman yields back. Thank you both for your presentations. Mr. Burke, you are now excused, and we will invite Mr. Goldman to take his place at the witness table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman?
Who seeks... For what purpose does the gentleman seek recognition?
I have a parliamentary inquiry.
Gentleman will state his parliamentary inquiry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Pursuant to Rule 7B of the House rules, the chairman is allowed to administer an oath, not mandated to. But it has been the practice of this committee to administer oaths to witnesses. I'm wondering why we have not administered the oath in this situation.
I'm going to administer the oath to the two witnesses who are now coming up before us to make presentation. The two gentlemen who just testified were not witnesses. They were making opening statements for the committees. We will now administer an oath to Mr. Castor and Mr. Goldman, who are now testifying in the capacity of witnesses.
But typically we administer oaths before opening statements.
Which we will... You know, for witnesses. For witnesses. Mr. Castor, we will now administer the...
Mr. Chairman, parliamentary inquiry.
General suspend. Mr. Castor was here with Mr. Burke presenting the report of the committee. That is the opening statement for the for this committee. They were not witnesses before this committee. Mr. Castor now and Mr. Goldman are witnesses before this committee, and I will administer the oath.
Mr. Chairman, if they were making presentation on behalf of members, the rules should apply.
The gentleman is not recognized.
Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
We welcome both of our...
Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
Who's seeking recognition?
Right here, Mr. Chair.
Gentleman will state his point of order.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, despite our repeated requests for access to the evidence, we received less than 48 hours ago over 8,000 pages of documentation. Mr. Chairman, if this were a court of law, you'd be facing sanctions right now by the Bar Association. The
gentleman will state his point of order, not make
a speech. Mr. Chairman, how are we supposed to process over 8,000 pages of documents that came from various committees?
The gentleman, that is not a point of order.
Hours.
That is not a point of order.
Mr. Chairman, not recognizable.
I will now proceed with the oath.
This document
the gentleman will suspend and not make a speech. Mr. Goldman, Mr. Castillo, please rise and raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm under penalty of perjury that the testimony you're about to give is true and correct to the best of your knowledge, information, and belief, so help you God? Let the record show the presenters answered in the affirmative. Thank you, and please be seated.
Each of you will have
45 minutes to present.
Chairman,
to help you stay within that time, there is a timing light on your table. When the light switches from green to yellow, you have 1 minute to conclude your testimony. When the light turns red, it signals your time has expired. Mr. Goldman, you may begin.
Mr. Chairman, I have a point of order.
Mr. Chairman, you have to recognize.
The gentleman will state his point of order.
Mr. Chairman, my point of order is this. In the previous point of order issued by Mr. Johnston of Louisiana, you ruled against his point of order because you said that Mr. Burke was a witness. You have just told us he was not a witness, but he was a staffer. As such, a staffer must avoid
the
impugning motivations. And if you're
Will
you let him finish his point of order, please?
Made his point of order.
No, Mr. Chairman, I haven't completed yet. The rule requires that members and staff not impugn the motivations of the president. What you ruled was that he was a witness. You've just told us he wasn't a witness. My point of order is that you were out of order in your ruling.
The point of order is not sustained. I've already ruled on it. He was not a witness. These two gentlemen
I appeal the decision of the chair.
That is not a rule.
You just said it.
It most certainly is.
It is appealable. Yes, it is.
Ms. Lofgren knows it is.
The ruling is not...
The point
of order is not sustained.
I appeal the decision of the chair.
I move to table the...
The motion, the appeal of the ruling of the chair is tabled. The clerk...
Get it. Save it for next step.
All in favor of the motion table say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No.
Motion table is approved.
I seek a roll call vote.
Roll call vote. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Nadler?
Aye.
Mr. Nadler votes aye. Ms. Lofgren?
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye. Ms. Jackson Lee?
Aye.
Ms. Jackson Lee votes aye. Mr. Cohen? Mr. Cohen votes aye. Mr. Johnston of Georgia? Mr. Johnston of Georgia votes aye. Mr. Deutsch? Mr. Deutsch votes aye. Ms. Bass? Ms. Bass votes aye. Mr. Richmond?
Aye.
Mr. Richmond votes aye. Mr. Jeffries?
Aye.
Mr. Jeffries votes aye. Mr. Cicilline?
Aye.
Mr. Cicilline votes aye. Mr. Swalwell?
Aye.
Mr. Swalwell votes aye. Mr. Liu?
Aye.
Mr. Liu votes aye. Mr. Raskin?
Aye.
Mr. Raskin votes aye. Ms. Jayapal?
Aye.
Ms. Jayapal votes aye. Ms. Demings?
Aye.
Ms. Demings votes aye. Mr. Correa? Ms. Scanlon? Ms. Garcia?
Aye.
Ms. Garcia votes aye. Mr. Neguse?
Aye.
Mr. Neguse votes aye. Ms. McBath?
Aye.
Ms. McBath votes aye. Mr. Stanton?
Aye.
Mr. Stanton votes aye. Ms. Dean?
Aye.
Ms. Dean votes aye. Ms. McCarcel-Powell?
Aye.
Ms. McCarcel-Powell votes aye. Ms. Escobar?
Aye.
Ms. Escobar votes aye. Mr. Collins?
No.
Mr. Collins votes no. Mr. Sensenbrenner?
No.
Mr. Sensenbrenner votes no. Mr. Shabbat?
No.
Mr. Shabbat votes no. Mr. Gohmert? Mr. Jordan?
No.
Mr. Gohmert votes no. Mr. Jordan? Mr. Jordan votes no. Mr. Buck?
No.
Mr. Buck votes no. Mr. Ratcliffe?
No.
Mr. Ratcliffe votes no. Ms. Roby?
No.
Ms. Roby votes no. Mr. Gates?
No.
Mr. Gates votes no. Mr. Johnson of Louisiana?
No.
Mr. Johnson of Louisiana votes no. Mr. Biggs?
No.
Mr. McClintock?
No.
Mr. McClintock votes no. Ms. Lesko?
No.
Ms. Lesko votes no. Mr. Reschenthaler?
No.
Mr. Reschenthaler votes no. Mr. Klein? Mr. Klein votes no. Mr. Armstrong? Mr. Armstrong votes no. Mr. Stubbe? Mr. Stubbe votes no.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Biggs, you are not recorded. Mr. Biggs votes no.
Has everyone voted?
No.
Has everyone voted the wishes to vote?
How am I recorded?
Ms. Scanlon, you are not recorded.
Aye.
Ms. Scanlon votes aye.
Mr. Correa?
Mr. Correa, you are not recorded. Mr. Correa votes aye.
Does anyone else wish to vote who hasn't voted? The clerk will report.
Mr. Chairman, there are 24 ayes and 17 noes.
The ayes have it, and the motion to table is agreed to. Mr. Goldman, you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Nadler, Ranking Member Collins, members of the committee. We are here today because Donald J. Trump, the 45th President of the United States, abused the power of his office, the American presidency, for his political and personal benefit. President Trump directed a months-long campaign to solicit foreign help in his 2020 re-election efforts, withholding official acts from the government of Ukraine in order to coerce and secure political assistance and interference in our domestic affairs. As part of this scheme, President Trump applied increasing pressure on the president of Ukraine to publicly announce two investigations helpful to his personal re-election efforts. He applied this pressure himself and through his agents working within and outside of the U.S. government by conditioning a desperately sought Oval Office meeting and $391 million in taxpayer-funded, congressionally appropriated security assistance, vital to Ukraine's ability to fend off Russian aggression. And he conditioned that on the announcement of these two political investigations that were helpful to his personal interests. When the president's efforts were discovered, he released the military aid, though it would ultimately take congressional action for the money to be made fully available to Ukraine. The Oval Office meeting still has not happened. And when faced with the opening of an official impeachment inquiry into his conduct, President Trump launched an unprecedented campaign of obstruction of Congress, ordering executive branch agencies and government officials to defy subpoenas for documents and testimony. To date, the investigating committees have received no documents from the Trump administration pursuant to our subpoenas. Were it not for courageous public servants doing their duty and honoring their oath to this country and coming forward and testifying, the president's scheme might still be concealed today. The central moment in this scheme was a telephone call between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on July 25th of this year. During that call, President Trump asked President Zelensky for a personal favor, to initiate the two investigations that President Trump hoped could ultimately help his re-election in 2020. The first investigation involved former Vice President Joe Biden and was an effort to smear his reputation as he seeks the Democratic nomination in next year's presidential election. The second investigation sought to elevate an entirely debunked conspiracy theory promoted by Russian President Vladimir Putin that Ukraine interfered in the last presidential election to support the Democratic nominee. In truth, as has been made clear by irrefutable evidence from throughout the government, Russia interfered in the last election in order to help then-candidate Trump. The allegations about Vice President Biden and the 2016 election are patently false. But that did not deter President Trump during his phone call with the Ukrainian president, and it does not appear to deter him today. Just 2 days ago, President Trump stated publicly that he hopes that his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, will report to the Department of Justice and to Congress the results of Mr. Giuliani's efforts in Ukraine last week
to pursue these false allegations meant to tarnish Vice President Biden. President Trump's persistent and continuing effort to coerce a foreign country to help him cheat to win an election is a clear and present danger to our free and fair elections and to our national security. The overwhelming evidence of this scheme is described in detail in a nearly 300-page document entitled The Trump Ukraine Impeachment Inquiry Report, formally transmitted from the House Permanent Selecting Committee on Intelligence to this committee a few days ago. The report relies on testimony from numerous current and former government officials, the vast majority of whom are nonpartisan career professionals responsible for keeping our nation safe and promoting American values around the globe. The evidence from these witnesses cannot seriously be disputed. The president placed his personal interests above the nation's interests in order to help his own re-election efforts. Before I highlight the evidence and the findings of this report, I want to take just a moment to introduce myself and discuss today's testimony. I joined the House Intelligence Committee as senior advisor and director of investigations at the beginning of this year. Previously, I served for 10 years as a prosecutor in the Southern District of New York when I joined the Department of Justice under the George W. Bush administration. The team that I led on the intelligence community includes other former federal prosecutors, a retired FBI agent, and investigators with significant national security expertise. The report that I am presenting today is based entirely on the evidence that we collected in coordination with the Oversight and Foreign Affairs Committees that were gathered as part of the impeachment inquiry into President Trump's actions. Nothing more and nothing less. The three investigating committees ran a fair, professional, and thorough investigation. We followed the House rules for depositions and public hearings, including the rule against agency counsel being present for depositions, and members and staff from both parties had equal time to ask questions, and there were no substantive questions that were prevented from being asked and answered. This investigation moved swiftly and intensively, as all good investigations should. To the extent that other witnesses would be able to provide more context and detail about this scheme, their failure to testify is due solely to the fact that President Trump obstructed the inquiry and refused to make them available. Nevertheless, the extensive evidence that the committees uncovered during this investigation led to the following critical findings. First, President Trump used the power of his office to pressure and induce the newly elected president of Ukraine to interfere in the 2020 presidential election for President Trump's personal and political benefit. Second, in order to increase the pressure on Ukraine to announce the politically motivated investigations that President Trump wanted, President Trump withheld a coveted Oval Office meeting and $391 of essential military assistance from Ukraine. Third, President Trump's conduct sought to undermine our free and fair elections and poses an imminent threat to our national security. And fourth, faced with the revelation of his pressure campaign against Ukraine, President Trump directed an unprecedented effort to obstruct Congress's impeachment inquiry into his conduct. And with that context in mind, I would like to turn to the evidence of President Trump's conduct concerning Ukraine. My colleague, Mr. Castor, just said that it revolves around 8 lines in one call record, but that sorely ignores the vast amount of evidence that we collected of a months-long scheme directed by the president. But I do want to start with that July 25th phone call, because that is critical evidence of the president's involvement and intent. It was on that day that he held his second phone call with the new Ukrainian president. The first in April was short and cordial, following the Ukrainian president's election success. But this second call would diverge dramatically from what those listening had expected. Now, just prior to this telephone call, President Trump spoke to Gordon Sondland, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, who had donated $1 million to the president's inaugural campaign, and who had been directed by the president himself to take on a leading role in Ukraine issues. Ambassador Sondland relayed the president's message to President Zelensky through Ambassador Kurt Volker, who had had lunch that day with President Zelensky's top aide, Andrei Yermak, who appears repeatedly through this scheme as President Zelensky's right-hand man. Ambassador Volker texted Mr. Yermak with President Trump's direction. Good lunch, thanks. Heard from White House. Assuming President Z convinces Trump he will investigate, get to the bottom of what happened in 2016, we will nail down for a visit to Washington. Good luck. See you tomorrow, Kurt. So even before the phone call with President Zelensky took place, President Trump had directed that Ukraine initiate the investigation into 2016, the debunked conspiracy theory that Ukraine had interfered in the election, in order for President Zelensky to get the White House visit that he desperately coveted. Ambassador Sondland was clear in his testimony about this quid pro quo.
Frequently framed these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
During this call with the Ukrainian leader, President Trump did not discuss matters of importance to the United States, such as Ukraine's efforts to root out corruption. Instead, President Trump veered quickly into the personal favor that he wanted President Zelensky to do, two investigations that would help President Trump's re-election effort. Witnesses who listened to the call described it as unusual, improper, inappropriate, and concerning. Two of them immediately reported their concerns to White House lawyers. Now let me just take a few minutes walking through that important call step by step, because it is evidence that is central to the president's scheme. Near the beginning of the call, President Zelensky said, "I would also like to thank you for your great support in the area of defense. We are ready to continue to cooperate for the next steps. Specifically, we are almost ready to buy more javelins from the United States for defense purposes." The great support in the area of defense included the nearly $400 million of U.S. military assistance to Ukraine, which one witness testified was nearly 10% of Ukraine's defense budget. And this support comes as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in 2014, when Russia illegally annexed nearly 7% of Ukraine's territory. Since then, the United States and our allies have provided support for Ukraine, an emerging post-Soviet democracy, to fend off Russia in the East. Yet just a few weeks before this July 25th call, President Trump had inexplicably placed a hold on military assistance to Ukraine without providing any reason to his own cabinet members or national security officials. The evidence the committees collected showed that there was unanimous support for the aid from every relevant agency in the Trump administration. Nevertheless, during the call, President Trump complained that U.S. support for Ukraine was not reciprocal, that somehow Ukraine needed to give more to the United States. What did he mean? Well, it became clear, because immediately after President Zelensky brought up U.S. military support and purchasing Javelin anti-tank weapons, President Trump responded, "I would like you to do us a favor, though, because our country has been through a lot and Ukraine knows a lot about it." Now, the favor that he referenced there included two demands that had nothing to do with official U.S. policy or foreign policy. First, President Trump said, "I would like you to find out what happened with this whole situation with Ukraine. They say CrowdStrike." As you saw yesterday, excuse me, I guess you have one of your wealthy people, it says. The server, they say Ukraine has it. There are a lot of things that went on, the whole situation. I think you're surrounding yourself with some of the same people. And he went on later, I would like to have the Attorney General call you or your people, and I would like you to get to the bottom of it. As you saw yesterday, that whole nonsense ended with a very poor performance by a man named Robert Mueller, an incompetent performance. But they say a lot of it started with Ukraine. Whatever you can do, it's very important that you do it if that's possible. Here again, President Trump was referring to the baseless conspiracy theory that the Ukrainian government, not Russia, was behind the hack of the Democratic National Committee in 2016. Not a single witness in our investigation testified that there was any factual support for this allegation. To the contrary, a unanimous assessment of the U.S. intelligence community found that Russia alone interfered in the 2016 U.S. election. And Special Counsel Mueller, who indicted 12 Russians for this conspiracy, testified before Congress that the Russian government interfered in the 2016 presidential election in sweeping and systematic fashion. Dr. Fiona Hill, an expert on Russia and President Putin, who served on the National Security Council until July, testified that the president was told by his own former senior advisors, including his Homeland Security advisor and his former National Security advisor, that the alternative theory that Ukraine had interfered in the election was false. And although no one in the U.S. government knew of any factual support for this theory, it did have one significant supporter, Russian President Vladimir Putin. In February of 2017, President Putin said, "Second, as we all know, during the presidential campaign in the United States, the Ukrainian government adopted a unilateral position in favor of one candidate. More than that, certain oligarchs, certainly with the approval of the political leadership, funded this candidate, or female candidate to be more precise." And if there was ever any doubt about who benefits from this unfounded theory put forward by President Trump and his associates, President Putin made it clear very recently when he said, "Thank God no one is accusing us anymore of interfering in U.S. elections. Now they're accusing Ukraine." In the face of clear evidence, not only from intelligence community experts, but from his own national security team, that Russia, not Ukraine, interfered in the 2016 election for the benefit of Donald Trump, President Trump still pressed the Ukrainian government to announce an investigation into this conspiracy theory. And why? Because it would help his own political standing. President Trump even sought to withhold an Oval Office meeting from the president of Ukraine until he fell in line with President Putin's lies, the leader who had actually invaded Ukraine. The second demand that President Trump made of President Zelensky during the July 25th call was to investigate the frontrunner for the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, former Vice President Joe Biden, and his son, Hunter. President Trump stated, "The other thing, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, and a lot of people want to find out about that. So whatever you can do with the Attorney General would be great. Biden went around bragging that he stopped the prosecution. So if you can look into it, it sounds horrible to me." Witnesses unanimously testified that there was no factual support for this claim. Rather, they noted that Vice President Biden was acting in support of an international consensus and official U.S. policy to clean up the Prosecutor General's office in Ukraine. Despite these facts, by the time of the July 25th call, Mr. Giuliani had been publicly advocating for these two investigations for months, while also using back channels to press Ukrainian officials to initiate them in support of his client, Donald Trump. Ambassador Sondland understood Mr. Giuliani's role very clearly. He testified, "Mr. Giuliani was expressing the desires of the President of the United States, and we knew these investigations were important to the President." To others, Mr. Giuliani was working at cross purposes with official policy channels toward Ukraine, even as he was working on behalf of President Trump. According to former National Security Advisor Ambassador John Bolton, Mr. Giuliani was a, quote, hand grenade who's going to blow everybody up, unquote. Near the end of the July 25th call, President Zelensky circled back to the pre-cooked message that Ambassador Volker had relayed to President Zelensky's top aide before the call. President Zelensky said, I also wanted to thank you for your invitation to visit the United States, specifically Washington, D.C. On the other hand, I also wanted to assure you that we will be very serious about the case and we will work on the investigation. In other words, on one hand is the White House visit, while on the other hand, he agreed to pursue the investigations. This statement shows that President Zelensky fully understood at the time of the July 25th call the quid pro quo between these investigations and the White House meeting that President Trump required and that Ambassador Sondland had testified so clearly about. Numerous witnesses testified about the importance of a White House meeting with the President of the United States, specifically a meeting in the Oval Office, an official act by President Trump. As David Holmes, senior official in the U.S. Embassy in Ukraine, said, it is important to understand that a White House visit was critical to President Zelensky. President Zelensky needed to show U.S. support at the highest levels in order to demonstrate to Russian President Vladimir Putin that he had U.S. backing, as well as to advance his ambitious anti-corruption reform agenda at home. In other words, the White House visit would help Zelensky's anti-corruption reforms. And that support remains critical as President Zelensky meets today with President Putin to try to resolve the conflict in the East. Now, the day after this phone call, President Trump sought to ensure that President Zelensky got the message. On July 26, U.S. officials met with President Zelensky and other Ukrainian officials in Kyiv. And President Zelensky mentioned that President Trump had brought up some, quote, very sensitive issues, unquote. After that meeting, Ambassador Sondland had a private one-on-one meeting with Andrei Yermak, President Zelensky's top aide, during which Ambassador Sondland said that they probably discussed the issue of investigations. At lunch right after that with Mr. Holmes and two other State Department officers, Ambassador Sondland pulled out his cell phone and called President Trump. Somewhat shocked, Mr. Holmes recounted the conversation that followed. I heard Ambassador Sondland greet the president and explain he was calling from Kyiv. I heard President Trump then clarify that Ambassador Sondland was in Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland replied, yes, he was in Ukraine, and went on to state that President Zelensky, quote, loves your ass, unquote. I then heard President Trump ask, so he's going to do the investigation? Ambassador Sondland replied that he is going to do it, adding that President Zelensky will do anything you ask him to do. After the call, Ambassador Sondland told Mr. Holmes that President Trump did not give a bleep about Ukraine and only cares about the big stuff that benefits the president himself, like the Biden investigation that Mr. Giuliani was pushing. To repeat, and this is very important, Ambassador Sondland spoke to President Trump before the July 25th call with President Zelensky and relayed to Ukrainian officials President Trump's requirement of political investigations in exchange for a White House meeting. And during that call, President Trump asked for the favor of these two political investigations immediately after the Ukrainian president brought up U.S. military support for Ukraine, which President Trump had recently suspended or put on hold. And at the end of the call, President Zelensky made a point of acknowledging the link between the investigations that President Trump requested and the White House meeting that President Zelensky desperately wanted. And then the following day, Ambassador Sondland confirmed to President Trump on the telephone in person that the Ukrainians would indeed initiate the investigations discussed on the call, which was the only thing about Ukraine that President Trump cared about. Now, it's very important to understand that this investigation revealed that the July 25th call was neither the start nor the end of President Trump's efforts to use the powers of his office for personal political gain. And you have to look at all of the evidence in context as a whole. Prior to the call, the president had removed the former ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch, to clear the way for his three handpicked agents to spearhead his corrupt agenda in Ukraine: Secretary Perry, Ambassador Sondland, and Ambassador Volker, all of whom attended President Zelensky's inauguration on May 20th. All political appointees, they proved to be more than willing to engage in what Dr. Hill later described as an improper domestic political errand for the president. On April 21st, President Zelensky won the Ukrainian election with 73% of the vote, and he had two primary platforms: to resolve the war in the East with Russia and to root out corruption. That same day, President Trump called to congratulate him on his win. Even though the White House press release following the call stated that President Trump expressed his shared commitment to, quote, root out corruption, unquote, President Trump, in fact, did not mention corruption at all on this call, just like he did not mention corruption on the July 25th call. Shortly after this call, President Trump asked Vice President Mike Pence to attend President Zelensky's inauguration. But on May 13th, President Trump did an about-face and directed Vice President Pence not to attend. An advisor to Vice President Pence testified that the inauguration had not yet been scheduled, and therefore the reason for the abrupt change of plans was not related to any scheduling issues. So what had happened in the 3 weeks between April 21st and May 13th, when Vice President Pence was originally invited and then disinvited or removed from the delegation? A few things. First, on April 25th, Vice President Biden formally announced his bid for the Democratic nomination for president. Then, about a week later, on May 3rd, President Trump spoke with President Putin on the telephone. One senior State Department official testified that the conversation between President Trump and President Putin included a discussion of Ukraine. Third, on May 9th, Mr. Giuliani told the New York Times that he intended to travel to Ukraine on behalf of his client, President Trump, in order to, quote, meddle in an investigation, unquote. But after public backlash and apparent pushback from the Ukrainians, Mr. Giuliani canceled his trip the next day, claiming that President Zelensky was surrounded by enemies of President Trump. At a critical May 23rd meeting in the Oval Office, President Trump said that Ukraine was corrupt and tried to take him down in 2016, the same false narrative pushed by President Putin and Mr. Giuliani. And in order for the White House meeting to occur, President Trump told the delegation they must talk to Rudy to get the visit scheduled. These comments from President Trump were the first of many subsequent indications that, in his mind, corruption equals investigations. In the weeks and months following, Mr. Giuliani relayed to both Ukrainian officials and the government officials that President Trump had designated at the May 23rd meeting to take a lead on Ukraine policy the directive from President Trump that a White House meeting would not occur until Ukraine announced the two political investigations that President Trump required. And well before the July 25th call, Ambassador Sondland and Volker also relayed this quid pro quo to the Ukrainians, including to President Zelensky himself. Ambassador Volker conveyed the message directly to President Zelensky at the beginning of July, urging him to reference investigations associated with the Giuliani factor with President Trump. And in meetings at the White House on July 10th, Ambassador Sondland told other U.S. officials and two of President Zelensky's advisors, including Mr. Yermak, that he had an agreement with Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney that the White House visit would be scheduled if Ukraine announced the investigations. One witness testified that during the second of the meetings, Ambassador Sondland began to review what the deliverable would be in order to get the meeting, referring to an investigation of the Bidens. The witness told the committee that the request was explicit, there was no ambiguity. And then Ambassador Sondland also mentioned Burisma, a major Ukrainian energy company that Hunter Biden sat on the board of. To the witnesses that testified before the committee, the references to Burisma was shorthand for an investigation into the Bidens. Ambassador Bolton, as well as his staff members, objected to this meeting for investigations trade. And Ambassador Bolton told Dr. Hill, "You go and tell Eisenberg, John Eisenberg, the legal advisor for the National Security Council, that I am not part of whatever drug deal Sondland and Mulvaney are cooking up on this. And you go ahead and tell him what you've heard and what I've said." Yet this was not a rogue operation by Mr. Giuliani and Ambassador Sondland and Volker. As Ambassador Sondland testified, everyone was in the loop, including Mr. Mulvaney, Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Perry, and their top advisors. On July 19th, Ambassador Sondland emailed Mr. Mulvaney, Secretary Perry, Secretary Pompeo, and others after speaking with President Zelensky. The subject was, "I talked to Zelensky just now." And Ambassador Sondland wrote, "He is prepared to receive POTUS's call," POTUS is the President of the United States, "will assure him that he intends to run a fully transparent investigation and will," quote, "turn over every stone," unquote. Both Secretary Perry and Chief of Staff Mulvaney quickly responded to the email, noting that given that conversation, a date would soon be set to schedule the White House telephone call. The evidence also unambiguously shows that the Ukrainians understood this quid pro quo and had serious reservations, particularly because President Zelensky had won the election on an anti-corruption platform. In fact, a few days before the July 25th call, Ambassador William Taylor, the acting U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and the former permanent ambassador to Ukraine, texted Ambassador Sondland and Volker, or rather he stated in his testimony, "On July 20th, I had a phone conversation with Mr. Danilyuk, during which he conveyed to me that President Zelensky did not want to be used as a pawn in a U.S. re-election campaign." But President Trump's pressure campaign on President Zelensky did not relent. And just 4 days later, President Zelensky received that message via Kurt Volker that he needed to convince President Trump that he would do the investigations in order to get that White House meeting. And as I have described, President Zelensky tried to do exactly that on the July 25th call with President Trump. In the weeks following the July 25th call, President Zelensky heeded President Trump's request, sending his top aide, Mr. Yermak, to Madrid to meet with Mr. Giuliani. In coordination with Mr. Giuliani, President and the President Trump's handpicked representatives, they continued this pressure campaign to secure a public announcement of the investigations. Now, according to Ambassador Sondland, and this is very important, President Trump did not require that Ukraine actually conduct the investigations as a prerequisite for the White House meeting. Instead, the Ukrainian government needed only to publicly announce the investigations. It is clear that the goal was not the investigations themselves, or not any corruption that those investigations might have entailed, but the political benefit that President Trump would enjoy from an announcement of investigations into his 2020 political rival, and against a unanimous assessment that showed that he received foreign support in the 2016 election. And for that reason, the facts didn't actually matter to President Trump, because he only cared about the personal and political benefit from the announcement of the investigation. Over the next couple of weeks, Ambassador Sondland and Volker worked with President Trump's aide, Mr. Yermak, to draft a statement for President Zelensky to issue. When the aide proposed a statement that did not include specific references to the investigations that President Trump wanted, the Burisma and Biden investigation and the 2016 election investigation, Mr. Giuliani relayed that that would not be good enough to get a White House meeting. And here you can see a comparison on the left of the original statement drafted by Mr. Yermak, the top aide to President Zelensky, and on the right, a revised statement with Mr. Giuliani's requirements. And it says, "We intend to initiate and complete a transparent and unbiased investigation of all available facts and episodes." And here's the critical difference. including those involving Burisma and the 2016 U.S. elections, which in turn will prevent the recurrence of this problem in the future. The only difference in the statement that Giuliani required and the statement that the Ukrainians had drafted was this reference to the two investigations that President Trump wanted and told President Zelensky about on the July 25th call. Now, ultimately, President Zelensky's administration temporarily shelved this announcement, though efforts to press Ukraine would remain ongoing. By mid-August, Ukraine did not make a public announcement of the investigations that President Trump required, and as a result, no White House meeting was scheduled. But by this time, the president was pushing on another pressure point to coerce Ukraine to announce the investigations. The hold on the vital military assistance that the president had put in place for more than a month, still without any explanation to any of the policy experts. Our investigation revealed that a number of Ukrainian officials had made quiet inquiries to various U.S. officials about the aid as early as July 25th, the day of the phone call. Inquiries by Ukrainian officials continued in the weeks that followed until the hold was revealed at the end of August. But this is important. It was important for the Ukrainian officials to keep it quiet, because if it became public, then Russia would know that the U.S. support for Ukraine might be on ice. So by the end of that month, the evidence revealed several facts. One, the president demanded that Ukraine publicly announce two politically motivated investigations to benefit his reelection. Two, a coveted White House meeting was expressly conditioned on Ukraine announcing those investigations. Three, President Trump had placed a hold on vital military assistance to Ukraine without any explanation, and notwithstanding the uniform support for that assistance from the relevant federal agencies and Congress. Ambassador Taylor testified that this quid pro quo between the investigations President Trump wanted and the security assistance that President Trump needed was crazy. And he told Ambassador Sondland, "As I said on the phone, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign." Now, in an effort to move the White House meeting and the military aid along, Ambassador Sondland wrote an email to Secretary Pompeo on August 22nd. He wrote, "Mike, should we block time in Warsaw for a short pull-aside for POTUS to meet Zelensky? I would ask Zelensky to look him in the eye and tell him that once Ukraine's new justice folks are in place, parentheses, mid-September, Z, President Zelensky, should be able to move forward publicly and with confidence on those issues of importance to POTUS and to the U.S. Hopefully that will break the logjam." Ambassador Sondland testified that this was a reference to the political investigations that President Trump discussed on the July 25th call, which Secretary Pompeo ultimately admitted to that he listened to in real time. Ambassador Sondland hoped that this would help lift the logjam, which he meant the hold on critical security assistance to Ukraine and the White House meeting. And what was Secretary Pompeo's response 3 minutes later? Yes. After the hold on military assistance became public on August 28th, senior Ukrainian officials expressed grave concern. Deeply worried, of course, about the practical impact on their efforts to fight Russian aggression, but also, and this goes back to why it remained confidential, also about the public message that it sent to the Russian government. On September 1st, at a pre-briefing with Vice President Pence before he met with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland raised the issue of the hold on security assistance. He said, "I mentioned to Vice President Pence before the meetings with the Ukrainians that I had concerns of that the delay in aid had become tied to the issue of investigations." Vice President Pence simply nodded in response, expressing neither surprise nor dismay at the linkage between the two. And following Vice President Pence's meeting with President Zelensky, Ambassador Sondland went over to Mr. Yermak again, President Zelensky's top aide, and pulled him aside to explain that the hold on security assistance was also now conditioned on the public announcement of the Burisma-Biden and the 2016 election interference investigations. Ambassador Sondland then explained to Ambassador Taylor that he had previously made a mistake in telling Ukrainian officials that only the White House meeting was conditioned on a public announcement of the political investigations beneficial to President Trump. In truth, everything, the White House meeting and the vital security assistance to Ukraine, was now conditioned on the public announcement. President Trump wanted President Zelensky in a public box. A private commitment was not good enough. Nearly 1 week later, on September 7th, the holds remained, and President Trump and Ambassador Sondland spoke on the phone. The president immediately told Ambassador Sondland that there was no quid pro quo, but, and this is very important, President Zelensky would still be required to announce the investigations in order for the hold on security assistance to be lifted, and he should want to do it. In effect, this is the equivalent of saying there is no quid pro quo, know this for that, before then demanding precisely that quid pro quo. And immediately after this phone call with President Trump, this was the precise message that Ambassador Sondland passed directly to President Zelensky. According to Ambassador Taylor, Ambassador Sondland also said that he had talked to President Zelensky and Mr. Yermak and had told them that although this was not a quid pro quo, if President Zelensky did not clear things up in public, we would be at a stalemate. And I understood a stalemate to mean that Ukraine would not receive the much-needed military assistance. Needing the military assistance and hoping for the White House meeting, President Zelensky finally relented to President Trump's pressure campaign, and arrangements were soon made for the Ukrainian president to make a statement during an interview on CNN where he would make a public announcement of the two investigations that President Trump wanted. In order for President Zelensky to secure the White House meeting and for Ukraine to get that much-needed military assistance. And although there is no doubt that President Trump had ordered the military aid held up until the Ukrainians committed to the investigations, on October 17th, Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney confirmed in public that there was such a quid pro quo. Let's watch what he said.
Those were the driving factors. Did he also mention to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. That's why we held up the money. Now, there was a report.
So the demand for an investigation into the Democrats was part of the reason that he was ordered to withhold funding to Ukraine.
The look back to what happened in 2016 certainly was part of the thing that he was worried about in corruption with that nation. And that is absolutely appropriate.
There you have it. By early September, the president's scheme was unraveling. On September 9th, the Intelligence Oversight and Foreign Affairs Committees announced an investigation into President Trump and Mr. Giuliani's efforts in Ukraine. And later that same day, the Intelligence Committee learned that a whistleblower had filed a complaint nearly a month earlier related to some unknown issue, but which the president and the White House knew was related to Ukraine and had been circulating among them for some time. And then 2 days later, on September 11th, in the face of growing public and congressional scrutiny, President Trump lifted the hold on security assistance to Ukraine. As with the implementation of the hold, no reason was provided. Put simply, President Trump got caught, so he released the aid. But even since this investigation began, the president has demonstrated no contrition or acknowledgement that his demand for a foreign country to interfere in our election is wrong. In fact, he has repeatedly called on Ukraine to investigate Vice President Biden, his rival. These and other actions by the president and his associates demonstrate that his determination to solicit foreign interference in our election continues today. It did not end with Russia's support for Trump in 2016, which President Trump invited by asking for his opponent to be hacked by Russia, and it did not end when his Ukrainian scheme was exposed in September of this year. President Trump also engaged, once this investigation began, in an unprecedented effort to obstruct the inquiry. And I look forward to answering your questions about that unprecedented obstruction. But in conclusion, I want to say that the Intelligence Committee has produced to you a nearly 300-page report. And I am grateful that you have offered me the opportunity today to walk you through some of the evidence underlying it. Admittedly, it is a lot to digest. But let me just say this. The President's scheme is actually quite simple, and the facts are not seriously in dispute. It can be boiled down to four key takeaways. First, that President Trump directed a scheme to pressure Ukraine into opening two investigations that would benefit his 2020 re-election campaign and not the U.S. national interest. Second, President Trump used his official office and the official tools of U.S. foreign policy, the withholding of an Oval Office meeting and $391 million in security assistance, to pressure Ukraine into meeting his demands. Third, everyone was in the loop, his chief of staff, the Secretary of State, and Vice President. And fourth, despite the public discovery of this scheme, which prompted the President to release the aid, he has not given up. He and his agents continue to solicit Ukrainian interference in our election, causing an imminent threat to our elections and our national security. Members of the committee, President Trump's...
Regular order, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen's time has elapsed. Point of order.
Gentlemen's time has expired. Mr. Deutsch.
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Gentlemen will state his motion.
I move the committee shall be in recess, subject to the call of the chair.
I move to motion. Table.
Move to the motion.
Move to table the motion.
It is a privileged motion. It is not debatable. All those in favor of the committee recess.
I seek a recorded vote.
The chair will say aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. No.
No.
The ayes have it. The committee... Roll call. The clerk will call the roll.
Mr. Nadler?
Aye.
Mr. Nadler votes aye. Ms. Lofgren?
Aye.
Ms. Lofgren votes aye. Ms. Jackson-Lee?
Aye.
Ms. Jackson-Lee votes aye. Mr. Cohen?
Aye.
Mr. Cohen votes aye. Mr. Johnson of Georgia?
Aye.
Mr. Johnson of Georgia votes aye. Mr. Deutsch?
Aye.
Mr. Deutsch votes aye. Ms. Bass? Ms. Bass votes aye. Mr. Richmond?
Aye.
Mr. Richmond votes aye. Mr. Jeffries?
Aye.
Mr. Jeffries votes aye. Mr. Cicilline?
Aye.
Mr. Cicilline votes aye. Mr. Swalwell?
Aye.
Mr. Swalwell votes aye. Mr. Liu?
Aye.
Mr. Liu votes aye. Mr. Raskin?
Aye.
Mr. Raskin votes aye. Ms. Jayapal?
Aye.
Ms. Jayapal votes aye. Ms. Demings?
Aye.
Ms. Demings votes aye. Mr. Correa?
Aye.
Mr. Correa votes aye. Ms. Scanlon?
Aye.
Ms. Scanlon votes aye. Ms. Garcia?
Aye.
Ms. Garcia votes aye. Mr. Neguse?
Aye.
Mr. Neguse votes aye. Ms. McBath?
Aye.
Ms. McBath votes aye. Mr. Stanton?
Aye.
Mr. Stanton votes aye. Ms. Dean?
Aye.
Ms. Dean votes aye. Ms. McCarsell-Powell?
Aye.
Ms. McCarsell-Powell votes aye. Ms. Escobar?
Aye.
Ms. Escobar votes aye. Mr. Collins?
No.
Mr. Collins votes no. Mr. Sensenbrenner? Mr. Shabbat? Oh. Mr. Sensenbrenner votes no. Mr. Shabbat? Mr. Shabbat votes no. Mr. Gohmert? Mr. Gohmert votes no. Mr. Jordan? Mr. Jordan votes no. Mr. Buck? Mr. Ratcliffe?
No.
Mr. Ratcliffe votes no. Ms. Roby?
No.
Ms. Roby votes no. Mr. Gates?
No, this is so they can have a press conference before Mr. Castor gets the chance to offer rebuttal.
Gentlemen,
nobody asked for this break.
The gentleman will suspend. The roll call is in progress.
Mr. Johnson of Louisiana?
No.
Mr. Johnson of Louisiana votes no. Mr. Biggs?
No.
Mr. Biggs votes no. Mr. McClintock?
No.
Mr. McClintock votes no. Ms. Lesko?
No.
Ms. Lesko votes no. Mr. Reschenthaler?
No.
Mr. Reschenthaler votes no. Mr. Klein? Mr. Klein votes no. Mr. Armstrong?
No.
Mr. Armstrong votes no. Mr. Stubbe?
No.
Mr. Stubbe votes no.
Has everyone voted the wishes to vote? The clerk will report.
Mr. Chairman, there are 24 ayes and 16 noes.
Motion to recess at the call of the chair is...
How long do we anticipate the recess? How long is the recess?
Well, the gentleman will suspend.
I'd just like to know how long.
The gentleman will suspend.
It's until they're done with their press conference.
The gentleman will suspend. The committee will stand in recess for 15 minutes. I will announce also that we've been in session about 2.5 hours. After the conclusion of the testimony and the cross-exams will be about another 2.5 hours. We'll probably stand in recess then before the commencement of the five-minute round of questioning. I would ask that people remain in their seats while the two witnesses are given an opportunity to leave. I would remind people in the audience that if they leave, they may not have their seats back when we reconvene. The committee will stand in recess and will reconvene in 15 minutes.